This is the smell of the leftover tuna fish sandwich you left in your lunchbox over the weekend in a Wimpy trash bag.
Wimpy, Wimpy, Wimpy!
Blech! And this is the smell of that same sandwich in a Hefty Ultra Strong trash bag.
Hefty, Hefty, Hefty!
Ah, smell the difference? Hefty Ultra Strong has Arm & Hammer with continuous odor control, so no matter what's inside your trash, you can stay one step ahead of stinky. And for bigger jobs, try the superior strength of Hefty Large Black Bags.
This is the Seahawkers Podcast, episode 331. I'm Brandon Schultz of the Military Seahawkers. Adam Emmert is traveling for work for a couple of weeks, but we're just a couple of days away from the draft, so what better time to bring on Rob Staton of Seahawks Draft Blog? Yes, the Seahawks, they only have three picks going into the 2021 draft, but you know what? I don't think that they're just going to leave with three picks overall, so we have to talk draft. We've got to get the word from Mr. Seahawks Draft Blog himself, Rob Staton. Rob, we've been doing this for, gosh, I think going back to 2015 now, and here it is, what, 6 years later? It just wouldn't feel like a draft season without having you on the show.
It's really to show how time flies. I mean, I you just sort of mentioning that it's 6 years now, and you think back to, you know, I can think back very easily to sort of like the 2015 NFL season and the 2016 season, and it just feels like the last sort of 2 or 3 years in particular have just disappeared, and here we are. It's 2021. We're in a draft, and you know, I'm 4 years, 3 years away from being 40. So time is really rapidly deteriorating. If there's anybody in their early 20s listening to this, I would suggest enjoy it, because the next 10, 15 years are going to go very quickly.
Lessons from the old men on the show. Now I'm in my 40s. When we were starting this, Rob, I was still in my 30s. So gosh, you know, and now that I think about it, the Seahawks have not been to the Super Bowl since we started doing this. So maybe we screwed this up. Maybe we shouldn't be talking in the off season.
Yeah, it's all our fault. Yeah, it's definitely not the Seahawks' fault or anybody else's. It's ours.
It's definitely superstition, and probably, you know, one thing that we didn't have anything to do with, it was John Schneider trading away most of his draft picks for this 2021 draft. And I'm kind of curious, because this impacts you and what you do. I have to think that people, when they come to Seahawks Draft Blog, they want to know who the Seahawks are getting in the first round, you know, kind of toward the second round. When they don't have any first round picks, how does this impact you personally?
It hasn't impacted me at all. And a couple of people have asked me about this, but during the season, it's still a lot of fun finding out which quarterbacks might go early. And the first player I wrote about in the 2020 season was Zach Wilson. And I watched a BYU game and thought, wow, I'd not seen this guy before. And even though I didn't think that the Seahawks would be looking at quarterbacks this year, I didn't anticipate any huge saga emerging with a quarterback in the offseason. I thought, I've got to write about this guy because he's really good. And he's ended up just going from strength to strength, and now he's going to be the number two overall pick. So you still get all of that. And most of my joy over the years of writing this blog has been just watching the college games and trying to work out how this thing's generally going to look. It's never really just been about trying to find the guys that Seahawks are going to go and draft. So it doesn't really affect me that much in that regard. I think later in the process it does, because, for example, you do the Pro Football Network Simulator, which I think is a great little tool. And last year I did about 7 or 8 of these things on YouTube where you just run through the first 2 or 3 rounds, and people couldn't get enough of it because the Seahawks had a pick in round one and then 2 second-round picks and 2 third-round picks or whatever. And there was so much to talk about and to think of the possibilities of who they could get in the draft. It was a really exciting time. And then this year, that's all gone. I mean, I did a simulation for the first time on, I think it was Friday, and I traded down for 56 because they're probably going to trade down for 56. I didn't have them picking until the 70s. You know, 60, 70 players are going to go off the board before the Seahawks pick. And it takes a bit of the excitement out of it. But I will also say that when you get past the Senior Bowl, most people want to know who are the guys the Seahawks might take in round 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, because all of the national guys are talking about who's going to go in the first round, who's going to go in the second round. What people want to know is, who are the likely Seahawks players who might be available in day 3 and the latter part of day 2? So that side of it still exists, at least.
Well, I know that's a part I want to get into, too. But I am kind of curious about the fact that they traded for Jamal Adams. They traded for Gabe Jackson. So that's, you know, helped take away from their draft capital they have going into this draft. Why do you think with this year in particular, they've decided to use their picks in these other ways?
Well, I think with Adams, I think it's pretty clear it's three things with Jamal Adams. One, they hadn't been able to add any real impact players to the defense before training camp last season. So when you were going into training camp and your main addition is Quinton Dunbar, and he's currently potentially going to be on the commissioner's exempt list as a best case scenario when they actually traded for Jamal Adams, and they could have been a lot worse than that. So you're thinking, right, okay, Dunbar might not be with us. We've lost Jadeveon Clowney. We have added Benson Mayoa and Bruce Irvin, and that's basically it. And I think that they felt like, we've got to do something on the defense. We've got to make it better. And here was an all-pro who was available, and they decided to make the move. And then at least they could go into the season having said, we've added Jamal Adams, and that was their impact player. So I think that partly played into it. I think they overreacted a little bit to the whole... At the time when the Adams trade happened, there was basically no Big Ten. There was no Pac-12. The SEC was saying, we're going to persevere and try and come up with a season. There was going to be like no small school football. I think that the Big 12 was... I think they were playing, but the ACC, I think they were playing. But it was unclear whether there was even going to be a college football season at all.
Right.
And I think that they decided, well, this next draft and maybe the one after is going to be so difficult to project that we might as well just spend our first two picks on Jamal Adams. But then, of course, the Big Ten did play to an extent, and the SEC got a full season in pretty much, and the ACC played a full season, and the Pac-12 was poor. You know, there's a few games here and there, but it was constantly on off. They've had a Senior Bowl. They've not had a combine. I think we have more information than we perhaps thought we would have had at the end of July, let's just say.
I suppose the one thing that they still didn't have, they didn't have their scouts out and traveling, at least not that I know of.
Yeah, that's true. I think it's telling, though, that we haven't seen that many veteran trades. We had, obviously, right at the end of the season, we had Jared Goff and the Matt Stafford exchange. And we've seen Carson Wentz go. But these are for quarterbacks. This Sam Darnold's gone now as well. You know, the quarterback market, if there's available quarterbacks, there'll always be some movement there.
Rodney Hudson went to the Cardinals. That was one of the bigger ones, I suppose.
But in the first round, we haven't seen...
Oh, first round, for sure.
You know, a flux of, well, you know, we might as well just give this pick away because we can't. I think what's actually happened is as the process has gone along, teams have thought, well, the cap's so hampered now and restricted that actually what we probably need to do is we need to get a starter in round two who, okay, there might be some growing pains there, but he's going to be on $800,000, you know, and we can safely say we've drafted a receiver, we're going to start him as a rookie, we're going to have growing pains, but he's on $1 million. So that's $1 million versus maybe a veteran on $5 million, and they've decided that that's how they're going to go with it. So I do think that at the time the thought process was valid. I think that maybe with hindsight, the cost of the Adams trade was a little expensive and perhaps inspired somewhat by their thought on what these next two drafts are going to be like. And then I think the other one, I'm afraid to say, was just a bit of desperation. I think that I think the Seahawks feel like they have, I wouldn't say that they have a shortened window where they have, I feel like they've got it. They feel like they've got to sort of get there in a hurry, and you see a lot of it. It's a lot of short-term thinking. There's not really any answers at some key positions long-term. Next year, there's no left tackle, right tackle, cornerback, either cornerback, free safety, starting tight end, center. You know, there's a whole bunch of positions that are kind of living in the here and now. It's like a one-year deal, and I think they're kind of putting all the chips into, okay, we're going for it. And then next year they'll do the same again. We're going for it and we're going for it. And I kind of feel it's probably going to be this way until Carroll eventually does retire now.
As far as the offensive line goes, I almost look at it as a strategy now that they've almost come to realize, and maybe they haven't, I don't think it's controversial, Rob, to say that they're not good at drafting offensive linemen. Like, that just historically, they haven't drafted well when it comes to the offensive line. You know, Damian Lewis is a guy who, you know, at least from his first year, looks like he'll be that guy. But Ethan Posick, after his first year, was all rookie, on the all rookie team.
Yeah, that all rookie list. Right. Yeah.
And they did bring him back this offseason, but clearly, you know, not somebody that other teams were coveting because they got him for $3 million. But it might just be how they have to get offensive line is going out and finding veterans. And unless you're either paying a premium in terms of free agency or you're paying a premium in terms of draft capital.
I think they've definitely determined, and I think they decided this after 2017, actually, when Solari came in. And I don't know if it's something that he's had an influence on, or maybe they just decided they were going to do this internally, regardless of who was the O-line coach, that they were going to start adding veteran proven players at a certain cost. You know, initially it was DJ Fluker and J.R. Sweezy. It's developed into people like Mike Yapati and Brandon Shell, Cedric Abui, people of that ilk that they've decided they're going to bring in. And I think part of that was because they'd gone the other way. You know, they drafted young players and tried to develop them, and that hadn't worked. So now they have decided, well, we'll get some proven players, and they may be at the back end of their career, but we'll get them for a couple of million dollars. We'll plug them in, and here we go. And obviously, Gabe Jackson's a bit more expensive, but he's still kind of in that mold, isn't he? He's a player that's maybe towards the end of his career, very proven, but they feel like they can slot him straight in. There won't be any growing pains there, and they'll be able to have a functioning left guard. And yes, Damian Lewis is thankfully been one of their big hits. I think that was a terrific pick. I think John Schneider said it after the draft, and I completely agreed with him, because all the way through the pre-draft process last year, I said, I think he's a top 50 pick. And it was ridiculous that he was still there in sort of the late 60s, I think it was, when they took him. So
was he one of the guys that you talked to last year?
Yeah. I interviewed him, and yeah. he was, and straight away, you just thought he's got everything. He's explosive. He's got long arms. He's absolutely mauled people in the SEC on an amazing LSU team. And one of the big things I was saying over and over again was, if you can't take too many players from the LSU team last year, because it was just so good. And then I was so pleased that they tapped into it, because they were just winners. They didn't just win the national championship. They basically destroyed college football last year. So, you know, tapping into that group was a wise thing to do. And I'm glad they did it twice. They picked two players from that team. Obviously, Stephon Sullivan's moved on, but, you know, Damon Lewis, really good. And I think that's just what they've done. I think that you make a really good point about they haven't drafted well enough on the offensive line. I don't think they drafted well enough at all. And that the players were there. I mean, if you actually sort of go back over the years, it's not the hardest thing in the world to do to sort of say, okay, well, this guy's got length, explosive traits. He played well on tape. Here you go. And the best offensive lines in the league are the ones where teams have drafted them and built them together. And they've had a degree of consistency there. I'm thinking straight away of New Orleans' offensive line. You know, they looking, yes, they spend high picks on players, but a lot of their biggest hits are Armstead in like round three and, you know, Ramchick end of round one. And it's like, well, you can actually kind of, you can build an offensive line if you're actually picking the right kind of players. And I think like last year was a good example. So we could all see that center potentially could be a bit of an issue down the line for the Seahawks. And there were some good centers in the draft, and there have been for the last 2 years. And the Seahawks don't take one. And then there was that, you know, they trade up for Daryl Taylor, but they wouldn't trade up like two picks for Cesar Ruiz.
Right.
And it's like, well, you know, and this is the part of the issue with the Seahawks is they always seem to go in, they sort of use free agency to fill certain holes, but they always leave a couple of holes for the draft. And they say, okay, what's the strong positions in the draft? It's this. Okay, we'll fill those holes in the draft. Whereas this is not me telling the Seahawks what to do. It's just sort of, you know, all fans have opinions.
Sure.
I have an opinion.
This is Rob's philosophy right here, everybody.
Yeah. I hate it when people go on my board and on my, you know, on this. So I don't have a board. I live in Rotherham. You know, I have opinions like anybody else who watches this game. My personal preference would be for teams to fill all of their needs in free agency, but basically, so that you in the draft, you can just go, okay, we're picking at like 27 or whatever. Who's the best player? You know, and or have we got a need? There's not an immediate need, but might be a need next year. So we can take this guy. I don't feel pressure to play him, but then in a year's time, he can step in there. And with the Seahawks, they don't seem to do much of that. And it would have been great last year to sort of say, okay, it's a good O-line interior O-line group. get a Cesar Ruiz, get a Damian Lewis, and say, and listen, what's Russell Wilson saying in a year's time? He's definitely not going on the radio show and going, well, pass protection is no good, because if you said, well, we've already invested two high picks in the O-line and then we go and bring Gabe Jackson in, and everything's kind of, and you've got sort of Dwayne Brown, Gabe Jackson, Cesar Ruiz, Damian Lewis, Brandon Shell, there's no argument there. And that looks like a really good group, but they don't use that foresight sometimes to say, okay, let's go and do this and let's build this. And the O-liners that they have taken haven't worked out. And I think they've missed on some really good, I mean, one of the, Joel Bitonio seemed perfect for them a few years, 2014, I think that was.
Yeah.
He's had a really good career. They didn't take him, took Paul Richardson instead.
Well, and you know, they kind of did address center in free agency last year with BJ Finney, and they kind of, it felt like they had him slotted in as the guy, but that completely bombed. I think The Athletic named him as one of the worst free agent signings of the decade for the Seahawks.
That seems like a little dramatic. I mean, he was crap, but I mean, he's, you know, one of the worst free agent signings in the death decade. Like a $4 million backup lineman is
right.
Stretching
out. And I can see because he didn't play, but you know, you also spent twice as much on Luke Jokel, and yes, he played, but he was terrible. So, you know, how do you weigh that? I don't know, but yeah. I think that's who they came up with.
The tough thing for me a year ago, there's nothing against Brandon Shell, who had a better year than I think most people expected. But I think between Shell, BJ Finney, and Cedric Ebuehi, that was basically the cost of Jack Conklin's first-year cap hit last year. And he was the all-pro right tackle. And you think, well, you know, it's probably that kind of... I mean, Russell Wilson's not daft. I mean, the guy never sleeps. There's absolutely no doubt whatsoever that he's on over the cap or whatever for an hour, you know, at one point in the offseason going, hang on a minute, you know, like that BJ Finney cost that and Shell and Ebuehi and Conklin all pro, he cost that?
Yeah.
You know, why don't we sign that guy? And then, you know, and then it just, of course he's saying that. I mean, the guy is too, all of the fuss.
If we're saying it, then obviously, you know, it's not a stretch to think that he would think similarly.
I think if there's one thing this offseason has shown us, is that Russell Wilson doesn't just go on holiday when the season finishes and forgets about everything until July. Russell Wilson is thinking about everything all of the time. And I think that he will have definitely sort of picked up on the fact that Conklin Cosby did. And if you make that move a year ago, and look, the fans are all happy, you know, no one's going, oh, clowny, everyone's just going, wait, they signed Jack Conklin. And then Russell Wilson's like, you know, he can't complain because they've signed Jack Conklin. And then everybody's kind of happy with it. But no, you know, Ebuehi, Finney, Shell.
Yeah, Shell was okay. Shell worked out. At least they hit on one of the three.
Let's hope he works out again this year.
Yeah. Well, he only has to be better than Ifedi, which I feel like the bar is set relatively low. Which, you know, historically, the bar for right tackle is set low. So it kind of leads me into, though, Rob, this idea of, based on how the team is constructed right now, where do you see the biggest and most immediate needs that they might be able to actually address through the draft?
It's a really challenging question. Because I suppose it depends how we're framing it. What is the biggest need in order for the Seahawks to succeed in 2021?
I would go with 2021 because, I mean, we could spend all day talking about, you know, who's the next Dwayne Brown, since he's played more games than Walter Jones, and you know, he was the best player on the offense last year, I felt, and I'm including Russell Wilson in that. He was just, Dwayne Brown was so consistent last season at such a high level. You know, for him to do that at his age, I guess I'm not as worried about him in 2021, but it is a position that I'm worried about that and beyond. And we weren't really worried about Walter Jones even until, you know, his knees stopped working. So I think we could talk about, you know, future at different positions, but I think immediate needs for me when I'm thinking offense, it still goes to center. And I feel you kind of leaning that way too with this discussion.
Well, potentially so. I mean, this is the interesting thing about it, though, because for me, the biggest need is I'm worried about, it's not just that Brown's is at the age that he is, he's out of contract at the end of the season.
Yeah.
So he could walk. I mean, it's not even a case, I'm not saying he will, but it's, if you don't re-sign him and someone goes, you know, oh dear, we, you know, the one thing that cost us last year was a left tackle, let's just throw a load of money at Dwayne Brown and he's gone. And I remember Riso Diambo, and I remember Bradley Sow.
Yeah.
Bradley Sow?
Yeah.
I'm thinking, once you've paid Jamal Adams, which I'm assuming they're going to, you've probably got about $30 million to spend next year. So it's not like you can just go out and say, well, we'll spend $20 million on the Trent Williams, the 2022 version of Trent Williams. So I'm starting to worry about this. I'm thinking you kind of need one in the chamber, so to speak. And the worst case scenario is maybe they replace Brown and Shell in a year if Brown stays. I'm thinking that tackle might be the most important need because I'm not sure a rookie center wins the job. Because you'd hope that they would. Because Posick, I don't
know.
But
see, then when you're talking tackle, Rob, you're saying, well, can they even address that need through the draft this year? Because if they're drafting at the back end of the second round, who's going to be left in terms of tackles?
And do you know what? 9 times out of 10, I'd say they've got absolutely no hope, except this is the one time out of the 10 when there's probably going to be 3 or 4 guys who, listen, you're not going to get a drafted guy in round 3 and say he's a surefire starting left tackle in the NFL.
Well, and that's true. You did say that this is the most explosive offensive line class that you've seen in recent memory.
It's the only draft class I can ever remember where I can safely say I would be comfortable drafting this tackle in at 75 and think that it's not beyond the realms of possibility that they could start for the Seahawks in 2022. So because of that, and because of the look, if they sign Dwayne Brown tomorrow, I'm ruling out tackle. You know, if they give him a 2-year extension or whatever next tomorrow, mm-hmm. we'd talk differently. I think right now, though, I'd rather have somebody contracted with the potential to start next year, having a year under Dwayne Brown, learning the ropes, wondering if they could be the answer, as opposed to having a massive panic in 12 months' time if Dwayne Brown retires or he moves on. So that's what I would say. But in purely, if we were thinking, right, this is all about winning this year, let's just say internally, Pete's decided this is my last season, let's just say for argument's sake, we need to win this year at all costs, then I would say, yeah, it may be a center, but again, rookie centers may or may not work.
Sure.
If he didn't beat out Ethan Posick, just because of pure consistency and knowing who's what to do and the calls and everything, then it's not an immediate need. I still think a third receiver could have a huge impact as a rookie. You know, look at DK Metcalf. Came in as a rookie, was drafted at the very end of round 2, had a sensational rookie season. If you're picking, Metcalf is what, pick 64? If you're picking in that range again this year, and you get a receiver who could, not maybe, it's asking a lot to match Metcalf's rookie year, but could do maybe 2/3 of that, then actually you're thinking, wow, you know, you've got Metcalf, Lockett, and a really exciting rookie, and this is a great receiver class, then you could be talking about a fantastic offense in 2021, and that could help the Seahawks really elevate. So I think in terms of short term, it may be receiver. In terms of looking ahead, not just this year, but sort of 22, 23, 24, it's O-line.
Well, looking at your draft board, Rob, I do see a lot of depth in terms of wide receiver. Let's stick on the offensive line, though, because I am curious, because I do think it's important to address whether they go offensive line or defensive line, always finding guys to fill in those areas. Defensive line, they've spent a lot of time in free agency filling those needs. So it does seem like offensive line, it would set up well to draft that either early. So let's start at tackle. Who are some of the tackles that could be available, and what are some of the traits about these particular players that you would like?
I suppose the first name that I'd like to mention is Donte Smith at East Carolina. When you get to the Senior Bowl, you just find these guys who you've not heard of. I believe it or not, there's not a lot of East Carolina broadcasts in the UK. So you don't really know these players. And they turn up, and you just see a guy stand out in the O-line, D-line drills. And Donte Smith was playing against some decent guys, you know, Boogie Basham from Wake Forest and Cam Sample and people like this, and having success. And you just sort of think, okay, I need to see a bit more of this guy. And then you will sort of watch him as the week goes on, and he's very angry and aggressive, and, you know, he's intense. He had one, I wouldn't even call it a bad rep. It was a great battle with the Houston pass rusher whose name I complete, Peyton Turner. Great battle with him, and Turner, it was a 50-50, and Turner maybe just won the rep at the end, but it could have gone either way, really. And he turns around, you know, and he's furious with himself that he's not won the rep. And I'm thinking, that's, you know, fantastic. You know, Dante Smith's playing someone who could go in round two here in a 1v1, and he's furious with himself because he's lost one rep in midweek in the Senior Bowl. And I interviewed him after the Senior Bowl, liked everything about him. You know, personality reminded me a bit of Damian Lewis. He's got everything that they look for, 35-inch arms, explosive test results, you know, explosive tester, good broad vertical bench, all of that. He's got what they like, and he's a player who can play guard or tackle, but has got the length that they really like at tackle. So I think he's somebody to watch out for. He had a lot of buzz after the Senior Bowl, and people were starting to say could go late round two. And as the time's gone on, people just stopped talking about him.
Hmm.
It's just like the forgotten man. And, you know, I look at projections now, and I see sometimes round three, other times sort of round four. I think that he would be the kind of player that the Seahawks would show some interest in. One or two others. Spencer Brown is too tall, I think, for the Seahawks. They've not really gone for those, you know, insanely tall tackles because leverage is an issue. But he was so explosive. There's a bit of a flutter around the sort of the draft community that he's may even go in the top 50. He's kind of stocky. He's going whoosh, because he had an amazing pro day.
You don't even see a lot of 6'9 guys in the NFL, do you?
No.
That's really tall.
You don't, and that is a concern, actually. You know, and when you actually watch him at the Senior Bowl, he had so many issues with leverage.
Mm.
And you think, I'm not sold, but the league seems to be convincing themselves that because of the testing, the frame, everything, his personality, that he's worth taking a chance on. And look, as a right tackle, I think he could work with a bit of protection from a tight end off the edge. But I don't think if you left tackle, you get underneath his pads and everything. He's going to take a long time, I think, to round himself into a consistent starter. But look, Eric Fisher did. And he was the number one overall pick. So, you know, I think that's... It wouldn't even surprise me, actually, if Kansas City took him, traded down in round one and took him and thought that they could develop him. Because they love those sort of big... They're even more on their traits than Seattle, as it happens.
Yeah.
You know, and they love those kind of guys. So I wouldn't be surprised if he was an option there. Alex Leatherwood, we know the Seahawks like drafting from Alabama. In the trenches, explosive tester, 34.5-inch arms. I think he's more of a guard, footwork's poor, didn't have a great Senior Bowl. But, you know, if he's there early round three, you know, he's a Alabama left tackle and guard type that you could fit around your O-line depending on what you needed. And then later on, you know, if people are looking for guys who they, let's say they go in a different direction early, but they still want to add a tackle later on to try and develop. I'd say some names to look out for are people like Tommy Doyle at Miami, another very tall guy, but has got great length, great size, explosive, somebody that they could look at to draft and develop. Dan Moore, 3-year starter in the SEC, tapes sometimes a bit hit and miss, but has gone up against the best of the best and had a reasonable career there. Explosive, long, ticks a lot of boxes. Landon Young at Kentucky. Very explosive, long, again, another guy that they could look at. So there's a few options.
Well, moving inside to center, another guy that you interviewed, you talked to Damian Lewis last year. This year, you've talked to Quinn Meinertz. And this guy is a character, for one. And, you know, why not make it back-to-back years, Rob, that you've talked to the guy that the Seahawks eventually draft?
Yeah, I loved speaking to Quinn Meinertz, and he was a great guy. And I, as soon as the Senior Bowl was on, you know, was wrapping up at the end of the week, I got in touch with his school and said, "Can you put me in touch with him? I'd love to interview him." And, you know, they replied within the hour, and I think they were really excited that people all over the world suddenly wanted to speak to one of their players. I spoke to his agent and then got in touch with him, and he just texted me out of the blue and was like, "Can we do it like in the next 10 minutes?" And I was like, "Yeah." So I just ran downstairs and did it. And he was unbelievable, you know, as great person, wonderful Senior Bowl.
And if people were watching the Senior Bowl, this was the guy that just like had his stomach hanging out, you know, wearing like the half shirt that, you know, Ezekiel Elliott would wear, except as an offensive lineman.
Yeah. And you know, the crazy thing about his week in the Senior Bowl is there were some reps that if anybody else had done what he was doing, they would have lost those reps and would have got torched by the people watching. So there was that a couple of times when he, like, people would get underneath him and like his back would arch back and he'd be off balance and you're thinking, oh, he's going to end up on his arse here, you know, and he recovered. I mean, I said to him in the interview, I said, I think you've got the strongest back in America. Because the number of times you were sort of bent backwards and recovered and didn't lose any ground whatsoever is insane. I mean, he's obviously got an incredibly strong core. I think he's, the best way I could probably describe it is he's kind of like in his early 20s, but he's already got dad strength. And he's kind of got like old man strength at his age. And if you're going to do the workouts that he did leading up to this process, which was like hunking around like big logs and tankers and stuff like this in Canada and chopping trees down, then that's obviously he's gone with the Rocky IV montage of a workout. And it's obviously paid off for him. And there just aren't many centers who are as explosive as he is with 33 and a half inch arms with 320 pounds. If you could make a center in a factory, he'd look a lot like Quinn Miners. So I think he's going to go a lot higher than a lot of people think. I think he's a top 50 lock.
So he might not even be there for Seattle when it's time.
I will say this. Somebody messaged me. I hope they won't mind me saying I won't mention any names, but somebody emailed me and said, and he knows somebody in it who works for a team. Mm-hmm. And they said that they're kind of a bit mixed on him. And I just wonder whether or not internally teams might go, well, he didn't play last year. Mm. And he played guard, small school level. It might put some teams off.
Yeah.
Especially when you've got Creed Humphrey and Landon Dickerson and Josh Myers and Kendrick Green as alternatives. There might be one or two who go, well, I can take him instead. But I'd be so surprised if there isn't one. That might be half the league. That still means the other half are willing to take him.
Yeah, it only takes one.
And that's why I think someone will take him in the top 50.
Well, I am kind of curious to see how the playing time from last season impacts the draft board. If we see guys who opted out last year slipping down the board and guys who did play moving up, and it might be a team-by-team thing. I'm just listening to some of the national media. It sounds like Dallas might be one of those teams that, you know, tends to lean toward guys who played last season. So, yeah, I'm curious to see how it plays out.
Yeah, I'm very curious. And I think one of the reports was that Miami are avoiding players who didn't play last year. Mm. And I think there are going to be, that's what's going to be crazy about this draft is, because I've said this a few times on the blog, I don't think people really have picked up on it. Because I've talked about a lot of things, obviously, and it's not about the draft, and I've talked about a lot of issues that I think needed to be talked about with the Seahawks this year, and people tend to sort of linger on those. One of the points I've made over and over and over again is that this is going to be a bit of a weird draft, and there are going to be players available that you perhaps don't expect in rounds 3, 4, and 5 for a variety of reasons, whether it is an injury issue, something that we haven't heard reported, a character thing or whatever, because there just isn't that buzz of pro days and journalists mingling with scouts and coaches and whoever. There are going to be players who sat out last year that we all assume are going to be round 2, and they might get punished for sitting out and not playing. And it might even be their fault for that they didn't play. Maybe they're a Pac-12 player and their team didn't play. And teams just go, well, we've only got 1 year of tape and it was 2 years ago on this guy. I mean, like Walker Little's a good example. He hadn't played for 2 years. Like, so if you're doing your tackle board and you're thinking, well, and let's say from the Seahawks perspective, if you drafted Walker Little, he probably isn't playing this year, all being well. So what are you saying? You're going to draft a player who's not played football for 3 years?
Right.
Potentially or more. These are the things that you have to consider as teams. And I actually think, and I don't think this is a justification for having hardly any picks, by the way. I just think this, you know, you can have this benefit whether you have 10 picks or 3 picks. I would rather the Seahawks have a lot more picks than they have, but they're going to trade down to the 60s and the 70s, I think. And there will be a bunch of players that perhaps a lot of people are surprised they're there. And their first pick might be somebody that everyone goes nuts about, because we didn't think there was any chance that they were going to be there at like 74 or something like that. And there they are, and they're taken. And we might all say, what a great move. But that's going to be this draft. There's going to be players all over the place.
Well, and one of the things that I think about now when you bring that up is, okay, how many teams are thinking that way, if other teams are thinking, okay, well, I'll trade back and accumulate picks, that's going to restrict the number of teams that are willing to move up and take guys because they're just hanging back to see who's going to fall. And then what if there aren't any trade partners for Seattle to trade back from with that second round pick? Now, I mean, that's probably there's probably always going to be moves to be
John
made.
John will find one.
he will. If there's a guy that and the league knows that John Schneider is willing to trade to move back, but there might not be as much value in it is one of my thoughts.
Yeah, I think you're perhaps right. It's interesting. I'm so intrigued by what's going to happen because one of the thoughts I've had recently is I had this conversation with a bunch of friends earlier today because somebody shared a mock draft that Charlie Casserly had done that had Justin Fields falling to 24. And so my mates were saying, well, isn't this ridiculous? What a load of nonsense. Fields isn't going to last to 24. And I said to them, look, Justin Fields is not as good as PFF or whoever might make out. He could easily go fourth overall, third overall, second overall, because there's lots to like about him. There's also a lot to dislike about him. There's a lot of things that a lot of teams are just going to go, I don't want to deal with his technical issues. I don't want to deal with that elongated release and the footwork and the toesiness and the inaccuracy and the, you know, WTF moments like we saw against Indiana. So he could go anywhere. Like, it wouldn't be a shock to me if he went 24th. It wouldn't be a shock to me if he went fourth. And equally, it won't be a surprise on draft day if you get to sort of the 20s and, oh, there's Kellen Mond. And he goes. And it won't be a surprise if Davis Mills goes in round one or Kyle Trask. If we saw
Trask is going a little far, Rob.
For me, I mean, I don't even have him on my board. So, you know, I wouldn't draft him because I think he's a really mediocre athlete. And I think the way that he finished last season scares the crap out of me, frankly. He was trying to outdo Jameis Winston with his interceptions. So I wouldn't draft him, but there's a bit of buzz there. And this is the thing, and the other thing we've got to remember is like, you look to next year, the quarterback draft next year looks horrendous. Sure. Now, there's always players that emerge. Who was talking about Zach Wilson 12 months ago?
Yeah.
Who was talking about Cam Newton the year before he went first overall? So there's always players that emerge. But you look at the quarterback draft next year, and right now it looks terrifying. So if you're a team who, like a Chicago or whoever, and thinks, well, we better take somebody this year because next year it's a disaster zone, I think Kellen Mond's really good. You could say, well, we'll trade back five picks and take him. Or Tampa Bay might go, well, Davis Mills, he could spend a year or two working behind Tom Brady. We don't have any needs, so we'll take Davis Mills at 32. Why not? If it doesn't work, who cares? We won the Super Bowl last year. It's like, well, yeah, it's a shot to nothing, really. So I think we could see some really unpredictable things happen in this draft.
Well, I am really curious about quarterback, and it's not really anything even to do with the Seahawks offseason, although, I mean, I kind of wish that the Seahawks would take quarterbacks more often just to have that opportunity of, you know, if Russell were to get hurt, you know, a guy that can come in and you can show off to other teams. And if he does turn out to be really good, then maybe you can get some, you know, some draft picks out of trading him. And I'm surprised John Schneider hasn't done that. So I'm glad you brought up some of the names that you're looking at, but I'm also interested to see, well, one who ends up going to the 49ers now that they have the third pick overall. But it's also interesting to me how I feel like a lot of the quarterbacks are being talked about within those first 4, 5, 6, 7 picks. And I wonder if it is a function of not having a ton of college tape, having guys opt out from last season. If teams are looking at quarterback and wanting to address them, I go back to a couple of years ago and you had Patrick Mahomes and Deshaun Watson going after Mitchell Trubisky. And this year, everybody who wants a quarterback seems to be wanting to move into the top five. The 49ers were willing to give up 2 future first round picks to do it this year. And I don't know, from what you're saying, it sounds like there could be a lot of variability of who that number 3 guy actually is.
Yeah. I mean, the quarterback position is one that you could do a whole hour long podcast on, because I think it's funny because one of the things I've noticed this offseason is we've had so many opinions and stuff. For example, one of the big pieces of football rhetoric is you can't do anything unless you have a franchise quarterback. You've always got to have an elite franchise quarterback. And every time I hear that, I think, yeah, but that sounds correct. But then I think, well, yeah, but, you know, Jared Goff was in the Super Bowl and Jimmy Garoppolo was in the Super Bowl. Nick Foles was the Super Bowl MVP.
Right.
In the NFC Championship game, he beat Case Keenum. You know, Joe Flacco was the Super Bowl MVP. Eli Manning's won two Super Bowls. Blake Bortles was like 5 minutes away from being in a Super Bowl. Yeah, do you know what? Because here's the thing. You don't want to be like the Bears right now, you know, with Andy Dalton as your starter. Of course you want better than Andy Dalton. You know, you 33-year-old Andy Dalton as your quarterback is not a place you want to be. But at the same time,
if you have an elite defense, he's a guy that could take you to that game.
But that's the thing. It's like, do you need... Right, so it's like... And then that's the other argument, isn't it? It's like, well, at the same time, how many Super Bowls did Drew Brees win? How many Super Bowls has Aaron Rodgers won? Right. How many Super Bowls has Russell Wilson won? You know, is it worth paying one guy $35 million plus a year versus having a guy on a cheap contract or a cheaper contract, you know, $20 million, $25 million, who just can manage your offense for you? And you combine that with a great O-line and a whole bunch of weapons or a masterful offensive coordinator or offensive-minded head coach like a Shanahan or a Sean McVay. And you put on the field great defensive players. So obviously, you know, Goff wasn't the reason why the Rams were there. It was Aaron Donald. And then Garoppolo wasn't the reason the Niners were there. It was because of Shanahan and because of Nick Bosa and that fantastic D-line. But it's like, well, what is the most important thing? And then, you know, you get into sort of this position now whereby, you know, the Niners are moving up three picks, I think, part because they think, well, just get a young guy who'll cost a fraction of the main guys for 4 years, then there's a fifth year option. And in that time, we can build up the defense and we can use that money elsewhere. And I think that's what their tactic is. And from a Seattle point of view, we sit here and we go, Russell's great. You know, Russell's a great player. It's fun to watch Russell Wilson. There's been many times over the last God knows how many years, Brandon, where you've thought, if the Seahawks didn't have Russell Wilson, what would they be? Right. And yet, at the same time, I'm sat here thinking, yeah, but they've won one playoff game in 4 years. You know, it's what is the best way? You know,
when you look at it that way, I don't think either way is wrong. It's just that if you're in the position, you take advantage of the position you're in. If you're the 49ers, you take advantage of, well, we know that Jimmy Garoppolo is not a franchise quarterback. So let's move on from him potentially, and we're building the defense. Let's find a quarterback that can, you know, maybe has an added dynamic that Garoppolo doesn't have, and hopefully can stay healthy the entire year, which Garoppolo hasn't been able to do. Take advantage of that while we're in that particular position. The Rams have been doing it defensively, and, you know, able to incorporate, you know, Sean McVay's offense in a way that, you know, puts pressure on a lot of other teams' defenses. So I think that in that regard, you say, well, the Seahawks might in this offseason have taken the approach, just, well, even going back to what the talks about them wanting to maybe go after Josh Allen. If they know that they can make that shift and they're, gosh, 90, because you can't be 100%, but you have to be so certain that you can get your guy and that guy can be the one to take you to the next level. Unless you're ready to lose your job, you can't afford to trade away a guy who is in that position that you know can win you a Super Bowl for a guy that you might take and then fail.
That's the point, because nobody's done it, have they? I wonder if somebody ever will. And I'm not just talking about the Seahawks here. I'm talking about anybody
right. Who
has a quarterback who is about Russell's age, 30 to 33, and they've not won anything for a while. And then they just go, we're going to trade him for 3, 4, 5 first-round picks or whatever the cost is. And we're going to go in a completely different direction. And what happens then? And whoever does that will have to be, very, like you say, will have to have great job security. I think that the Seahawks, I actually think John Schneider's job security, apart from the fact he's just signed a new contract, I'm with Carol. You know, if there was anybody who would ever be willing to do it, it would probably be them. And I think for a period this offseason, they considered it. It's just like you say, if you're going to do it, you have to know that the guy you are drafting, you believe in. It's not about having anybody who is cheap. Mm-hmm. It's about having someone who is cheap that you think, yes, we can win with this guy. And that's the thing. And that's why you hear the stuff about, well, if Mahomes had been in the end of round one, Seattle would have taken him. Oh, the Seahawks were thinking of drafting Josh Allen if they could do a deal. you can sort of, with hindsight, say, well, I can see now why the Seahawks are thinking that way. And when you look at this draft class, you sort of go, who is the Mahomes and Allen from this? And I struggle to find who that is. There are players that, I mean, I really like Kellen Mond. Would I ever be
not even Trevor Lawrence or Zach Wilson?
Well, I think with Lawrence, yes, but okay. it's a bit like saying, well, you know, he's this year's Andrew Luck. I mean, yeah.
He's been talked about so little that we just gloss right over him. Okay, so I just wanted to go back and pin you down on that.
Yeah, but everybody else, it's like there's nobody else that I mean, like I said, I love Kellen Mond. Would I be willing to, if I was in John Schneider's shoes, would I be trading Russell Wilson away and throwing all my lot in with Kellen Mond? That would be a challenging decision because I don't think it's different. It's just different. So you've got to have the conviction of it. But I think it's a fascinating discussion to have because I think the beauty of the NFL is there are so many different ways to skin a cat, to coin a phrase. Sorry for all you cat lovers out there. It's not about one size fits all. You can have different styles of offense that win, different styles of defense, different roster building strategies, different kinds of personalities of coaches, different kinds of personalities of players. Cultures can be different. It's just a great big melting pot of ideas. And there isn't a set way of winning. I think what has succeeded in the last couple of years are pretty much complete rosters. That's kind of what you've got to have.
Well, and the easiest way line, to get it. Defensive line and having strength at that position, because once we saw the Chiefs get to the Super Bowl and injuries on the offensive line and they can't protect Patrick Mahomes, their hopes kind of melt away.
And the easiest way to have a complete roster is not to be paying somebody a huge salary. And that's not just a quarterback. It's if you actually run through the books, salary cap, there was kind of like Brady's was about 28 million. You had a whole bunch of players who were on like, I think the next highest was like 14 million. So you weren't paying anybody a huge amount of money. And that's interesting. It interests me. It makes me, as someone who writes a draft blog, and this is not me saying trade Russell Wilson because that's not what I want to happen. And, you know, people read my off-season plan at the start of the year, well, no, I didn't want to do that. I'm just sort of saying it. I think it's an interesting topic, especially when you get, if in a year's time, the Seahawks still have only got like one playoff win in 5 years, it should be a conversation we have wondering about.
Because the question could be, can Russell Wilson even win in the playoffs with Pete Carroll? And you have to make a decision on which one might be impacting that. Maybe it's both. Who knows?
Yeah. And that's great. It's a roster strategy thing. It's as much as a game plan. It's what's the path to be on to success.
We can save that discussion we won't have that discussion next year because they're winning the Super Bowl this season, Rob. So
how do we go from Quinn Miners to that?
I don't know. I was just getting ready to ask you about Creed Humphrey because that's one of my Oklahoma guys.
Creed Humphrey, you know what? There's so many nice moments on tape where his combo blocking is fantastic. His willingness to reach to the second level and smack a linebacker down on his ass is a joy to behold. He contains very well. There are some technical issues, and this showed up at the Senior Bowl, Brandon, where his hand placement isn't great. Starts off outside and then works inside. He's so explosive that he kind of gets away with it, but he needs a bit of time to work his hands inside. And he's not always going to get, I mean, like against Aaron Donald, you're not going to get that time because he's going to be off. He's going to get off your block and he's going to be in the backfield. So that is a slight issue, as is the lack of length. But there are so many other things to like. And with Quinn Miners, explosive centers like that do not generally last long. I think the Jets, with their pick at the top of round two, would be a great landing spot for Creed Humphrey.
Well, how about Brady Christensen? Because this is an interesting spot. You have him in with your centers in your draft preview. He played left tackle for Zach Wilson at BYU. And, you know, maybe he doesn't have the size to play left tackle, but you think that he might be a guy who can move inside. And you say he's one of the most explosive guys in terms of your trench explosion formula, which was developed. You developed that under Tom Cable based on some of the traits that he mentioned that the Seahawks were looking for. And he has. And so you've continued to track these particular traits with regard to offensive linemen. Well, I suppose you track him with defensive line too, but in terms of his explosiveness testing, you have him off the charts, really.
Yeah, one thing I found with the formula was that it was identifying like the most explosive players in the offensive line every year, and most of them, you know, the most explosive players would then go very, very early in the draft. And it wasn't just a Seahawks thing. It was like a league-wide thing. Mm. So I think generally what Cable was doing all those years ago at that town hall meeting was kind of pulling back the curtain on how the league is assessing offensive linemen, not so much just him. And the Seahawks have continued to draft these really explosive offensive linemen. Phil Haynes, for example, was one of the most explosive offensive linemen in his draft. And Damian Lewis was as well. So it's something that teams are paying attention to. And Christensen is the most explosive offensive lineman we've ever tested. When he enters the league, he will, I think I wrote this down, he'll be one of the five most explosive players in the entire NFL in day one. There's basically Myles Garrett and three other people who are more explosive than he is. Now, the thing about Christensen is he is short legs, big, long body. So not a tackle frame.
Interesting.
That works well at center. And he has 32-inch arms, which is not ideal for tackle or guard, but is not so much of an issue at center. So I think he could easily work into that role. The problem with him, and this is why he's probably going to last a little bit, is because he's 20, I think he's 25 already. He's an older player. He's been at BYU. I'm presuming he's been on a mission for him to be that age.
Right.
So he's already in his mid-20s. So that will have an impact on his stock. And I think that sort of caps him off at probably round three as his kind of starting point range. But if you want someone who can get after it, explosive, tough, physical, and an athlete who can legitimately stand across from Aaron Donald and go, let's get after it, I'm as explosive as you are, he's an option.
I like it. Well, let's move on to running back, because the Seahawks have some pretty good depth at guard, so, gosh, I don't know. Should we spend some time there? I felt like we glossed over linebacker last year, and then they went and took linebacker in the first round.
But let me just sort of run through some names very quickly as a quick run through, because the one thing is, I hope they don't do this, Brandon, but they could easily move Damian Lewis to center. I mean, it's a very Seahawks thing to do. I think Damian Lewis played so well at right guard. They just drafted a guard. I want to keep him at guard.
And why wouldn't you just draft a center if you're going to move Damian Lewis to center? But
it is a Seahawks thing to do, sure, to move him to center. And, you know, the fact they've already tried it in one game and it worked, it was like, well, don't give him any any encouragement. And it could. And there are some guys. I mean, Kendrick Green, for me, is a player to keep an eye on. Because if the top centers go as high as I think they will, Kendrick Green could be plan B. And he is a player that's played center and guard, very physical. He's actually marginally more explosive than Quinn Miners. He just doesn't have the length. That doesn't matter as much at center. He has got the big hands, very aggressive. And I think that Kendrick Green is a name, when the draft is going on, just keep that name in your mind. Because if they do want to go center early, and if Quinn Miners and Creed Humphrey and Landon Dickerson go off the board, Kendrick Green is somebody who could easily be their guy. At guard, you've got a few names. I mean, I love Big Ben Cleveland, the Mountain from Game of Thrones. I think he could easily go in round two or round three.
Dylan Raddins was a guy I wanted to ask you about, because it was the North Dakota State Pro Day that John Schneider went out to, and that's where the discussion happened around Russ. But they also have Dylan Raddins, who could be an offensive lineman that the Seahawks are interested in.
Yeah, he's. I think he's a guard. I think he's not got the length to play tackle. I think he will have to kick inside to guard.
Because he was their left tackle, right?
Yeah, he was their left tackle. And look, didn't have a bad year and played well at the Senior Bowl as a tackle. So yeah, that has to be said. But I think with the frame, it's a guard frame. And I think he has to kick inside. There's been a few reports about his practice habits aren't great, which might worry some teams. He's not one of the players that I've interviewed. I've interviewed about 15 and he's not one of them. So I don't know what he's like as a personality. Mm. But he's an option. If they were going to go guard, if they wanted a tackle who could play guard, you know, we know they've taken those players in the past. Dwayne Brown's only got, I think, 33.5-inch arms. So it's not that they're completely against that kind of player. So they could draft him as a tackle. I just think that he is more of a guard. Liam Eikenberg's got very short arms. He will not be a tackle in the NFL. He's very consistent, slightly below the explosive traits of some of these guys that we're talking about, but is a guy that is the kind of player that you could easily imagine him playing 10 years in the league. Might never be an all-pro, but will lock down, I don't know, left guard for a a decent chunk, and you'll never worry about that position. You know, you'll just always have a solid starting player in that range. Trey Smith, if Trey Smith's tape was all right, not even good, just all right, and if he hadn't had the blood clot issue at Tennessee, it could be a first round pick, because he looks like he was built in a factory to play guard in the NFL. It's got everything: length, frame, carries the weight superbly. He looks like a heaven sent offensive lineman, but the tape is rubbish. And, you know, I remember someone said to me once, this was a couple of years ago, "What do you think of Trey Smith?" And I was like, "Nah, tape's not very good." And he liked the tweet. Which, and I'm always a bit worried when I prefer my offensive lineman not to be on Twitter. when they're on Twitter liking random tweets by people who have not tagged them in the tweet because they're searching for their name.
That's what they're doing.
It's what Justin Britt used to do. And that worried me. And this worries me. I wish he wasn't doing that.
Yeah.
So he may last because of the health reasons. Aaron Banks, Notre Dame, really good. I think that's pretty much everybody I want to mention. I mean, I mentioned Ben Cleveland. Wyatt Davis is another guy who is he's kind of all over the place in mock drafts. Could see him go somewhere like Cincinnati very early in round two. Could see him last in round three. But it's a good guard class. But I think you're right. I think they're probably done at that position.
Well, let's move on to running back, because you know, the Seahawks went three straight years picking a very prototypical type body. Well, then it's in the Pete Carroll era, they've always looked for certain types of guys, right? And they've gone with CJ Procise, Chris Carson, Rashad Penny, 2016, 17, 18. They skip a year in 2019, and then last year they take DJ Dallas. So with Carson coming back, it feels like they might be okay. But then you hear talk that they were involved with getting Giovanni Bernard, and so there may be some room for a draft pick here. I'm not even sold on the idea that Penny could. Gosh, they could cut him and have cap savings and then have a guy who can be healthy throughout the season. And, you know, it just wouldn't surprise me if they were to make even that kind of move.
There are quite a few positions on the roster where you assume that they're sorted. But I think if we actually spend some time thinking about it, they could do with more. And running back is one of those. Because as you say, what can you really expect from Rashad Penny? It's hard to sort of invest any faith there. Could be serviceable. You could easily imagine him getting hurt in training camp and has not seen him for 8 weeks. So it's, or him just being ineffective. It's a busted pick. And, you know, I'm not writing him off, but at the same time, I've got no faith in him achieving anything this year. With Chris Carson, they had to mother him through last season. And a lot of people thought they're just going to move on, and they couldn't. And then his market was so weak in free agency that he's come back at a very discounted price. Maybe they'll feel like they can use him more now that he's paid to an extent and they can just go with it. But he's had injuries. He needs to play 16 games in playoffs before we can invest any faith that he can ever do that. And then behind that, you've got Alex Collins, who knows if he'll get out of training camp. You've got DJ Dallas, seems like a nice guy, but is he an NFL running back? I mean,
they told me last year he was the next Terrell Davis. So I've heard people say that.
Yeah.
And I didn't really see it though. So that's the problem.
When you play him for a game and then the next week you're like, is that Bo Scarborough?
Yeah.
What are you doing? Stop watching Netflix. You're playing against the Rams next week,
exactly.
Whatever it was. And then Alex Collins was the same. They pulled him off the couch to play instead of DJ Dallas.
Right.
It's like, well, that's not not really a good sign. And Travis Homer, bless him, gives everything. And he's a great.
I think you just have to say that every time you use Travis Homer's name. Bless him.
Yeah. he gives everything, and you can't dislike the guy. And his pass protection is fine. And look, and everyone says that's a value, and it is a valuable thing.
Oh, yeah. But they got him in the sixth round. I have no complaints about Travis Homer being on the team, but I want to know. I want a future running back that they can give the football to consistently 20 times a game. You don't have to worry about it. I see Travis Etienne listed in your second round guys, but I don't know if he's going to be available for the Seahawks.
He won't be. No, I think that Atlanta at the top of round two is probably his floor.
Yeah.
It's not a good draft for running backs. personally, I don't think. There's been some better, like last year was a good one. And obviously the one where they took Penny was a good one, but they took the wrong guy. It's not good. And I think Javonte Williams, if you gave Pete a chance to draft anybody, he might draft Javonte Williams in this draft because he's what he wants. Bulldozers people out the way, yards after contact, a battering ram, and just a fantastic player to watch. Even now, I kind of there's like 20 minutes of highlights from the ACC on YouTube, and I'll just watch it as for a treat every now and again. It's so good. I think that there's more since his pro day when he was a little lighter than expected. He had to run faster. I think that maybe I thought he might go round one, but now I think solidly round two. I think before 56, though.
Yeah.
The top two will be gone. You know, a lot of people like Trey Sermon. You know, Trey Sermon's become the trendy draft Twitter guy. You know, that everybody's suddenly like, oh, Trey Sermon might be the best running back in the draft. And it's like, well, he's not. But, you know, if you say it enough times and it happens, you'll no doubt be mentioning that for the next 5 years. Trey Sermon had a flash. He was a flash in the pan at the end of last season. You know, had a great game against Northwestern, had a great game in the semifinal of the college football playoffs, got injured on the first snap of the championship game, and that was it. And that's him. That's him. You know, you draft him in round three and he's like Carson. You probably have to baby him through the season. And he's got talent and he's explosive and he's in the Seattle's ballpark, but I don't see a bell cow. And then you've got people like, I mean, Kylin Hill.
See, this is a guy that I like. When I see that he decided to opt out when his coach would have been Mike Leach, this is a guy who makes good decisions.
Yeah, that was quite amusing. I thought the stuff to like about Kylin Hill, it's one of those, though. It's like, do you see Kylin Hill being a great NFL running back? And that's just a question I can't say yes to. It's like, well, you know, yeah, is he worth a day three pick? Yes. Could he fill in as a backup? Yeah. He's kind of like a Robert Turbin type to me. He's like that kind of guy who will be in the league for a few years, will never be a starter, can fill in every now and again, but that's kind of it. That's kind of what I see him being. And then there's Chris Evans, who was the next big thing, you know.
I can't go
3 years ago.
I can't let you go on without defending Robert Turbin, who was, you know, who I actually interviewed this offseason. So, you know, I can't stand for any bad mouthing of Robert Turbin, Rob.
Listen, I apologize. And this is certainly, it was certainly no slur on my somewhat derogatory review of his career. It was, I just love the pick. I mean, he was one of the guys that we talked about before that draft, the 2012 draft. Loved everything about Robert Turbin. The muscles were, I would kill for biceps like that. The amount of time I spend in the gym to try and look like Robert Turbin,
you'll never get there.
I never get there is unbelievable. So and it certainly did not mean any offense to him if he's listening. But yeah, on Chris Evans was the next big thing at Michigan, and you know the sort of Thomas Rawls kind of vibe. It not completely different situation. Thomas Rawls has to be said, who left Michigan for a certain reason, and that is not Chris Evans. Chris Evans was just underwhelming on the field. There was nothing more than that. Didn't live up to the expectations, but is an incredible athlete, very very talented athlete, and could be somebody that you get like undrafted round seven, round six, and end up being something. But I'm not optimistic, and I worry a little bit about this position group because it's cost Seattle. I think part of the reason they had their slump, you know, at mid-season last year was all of a sudden the running backs were injured. And the year before, right before the end of the season and going into the playoffs, the running backs are all injured. It just discombobulated everything.
Right.
And this is an offense that when it's been at its best, it's got a good running back. And they've missed, we talked about the offensive line. You know, they've missed the chance to draft Nick Chubb, who was right there for them as their perfect prototype.
Brian Schottenheimer coached him in college and they didn't take him. And I thought, well, that just, he must know something then because he's not taking Nick Chubb and not pounding the table for him. They go for Rashad Penny instead. What happened? How could this happen?
Don't get me started. I mean, it's what I tell you why it happened is because they overthought they finally got injured 2 years before the draft.
Right.
And then according to John Schneider, Rashad Penny had the best durability grade they've ever given.
I remember talking about that too.
It's like the best durability grade given to a guy who started for 1 year in the Mountain West for a team who they're running the old running back who started ahead of Rashad Penny was 160 pounds and set the NCAA record for rushing yards. It's like, this is not a tough conference. Nick Chubb was starting in the SEC. He guided Georgia to the playoff championship, the national championship game.
Yeah.
It's like, he's everything you've ever wanted. They could have had him. Like, honestly, I feel very passionate about this. I think the Seahawks legitimately could have been in serious, serious Super Bowl contention if they just took Nick Chubb in 2018. Oof. Because think about Marshawn and what Marshawn did to this offense.
Yeah.
I genuinely believe, look, I'm not saying Nick Chubb's Marshawn, but Nick Chubb's really good, and you can guide an offense, and he can complete your offense and complete your team, and you can rally behind that. I genuinely believe that will be. Look, Lance Zierlein was tweeting with Jim Nagy a few months ago, and he said, I know one team that really regrets taking Nick Chubb and has constantly regretted it. And then he put a picture of it was an image of I think a nickel coin, mm-hmm. a penny. And I was like, you are just trolling Seahawks fans with that, Lance. And that's I bet John Schneider has nightmares of being chased around CenturyLink Field by a 20-foot Nick Chubb going, what were you thinking? That's what the 20-foot Nick Chubb is shouting.
Yeah.
As John runs around in CenturyLink Field. And look, I think it's cost him. And there's other players too. I mean, you just think of like Derrick Henry was there, and Dalvin Cook was there, and Jonathan Taylor was there. And you think you could have had any of these guys. I know that a lot of Seahawks fans hate the running back position and will hate us for talking about it in this way. But whether we like it or not, Pete Carroll's style of play kind of needs a good running back, and they don't have one who can stay healthy.
And Russell Wilson's play might even, yes. you point to that too. When he's at his best, he has an outstanding, you know, guy back there. And it's, you know, whether it's a healthy Chris Carson, whether you look back to Marshawn, it's worked. And that's the way that we've seen it work best.
Yeah. And look, Travis Etienne's a good player that you mentioned there, because I don't know if the Seahawks would even draft Travis Etienne, because he's although he's explosive and he's got the size and he's got the speed, he's not sort of that physical. He's not a Nick Chubb, and that's, you know, Nick Chubb. I just can't
stop talking about Nick Chubb, Rob.
I know. I'm sorry. When I watch him play, you just think, this is it. This is Seahawks. It's like you watch the Browns. That's why whenever I watch the Browns, I find it really difficult to enjoy watching a Browns game.
Yeah. Well, he was a big reason for Baker Mayfield's success last year. So,
well, partly is because Baker Mayfield is quite irritating, but the other reason is because Nick Chubb and Kareem Hunt and that offensive line is what the Seahawks. It's the dream. It's what they want. You know, they play a style of offense that the Seahawks want, and they've invested in the O line. And they've got two great running backs. I'm thinking, why haven't you done that? You know, why didn't you sign Kareem Hunt and Nick Chubb and draft Nick Chubb? Why didn't you sign Jack Conklin? Why didn't you, you know, it's, man.
You're banned for the rest of the episode from saying Nick Chubb now, Rob. We have to move on to tight ends.
I'm done. But the overall point is that I don't think it's a very good running back draft.
Has you longing for, what was it, 2018?
Well, I did enjoy the 2018 draft, as I was telling Tony Pauline the other day, because I was in Florida, and 3 years ago I was in Florida right now, and I'm in Rotherham instead. So, yes, I am pining for 2018. Yeah.
Well, tight end is a spot, Rob, that I think that, this is another area where I think it would be easy to overlook, because they did go out and get Gerald Everett. They're bringing back Will Dissly. And, you know, they have Colby Parkinson, who they drafted last season. But I think that, you know, there's the potential for maybe a fourth guy to mix in here. And, you know, we have the short shuttle speeds, the three cones. Well, actually, I'll ask you that. Do we have enough data even to know if there's guys out there who fit the mold for Seahawks at tight end with their short shuttle and three cone times?
Yeah, I mean, overall, it's a honking tight end class. It's even worse than the running back class. So, but one thing we have learned is that the Seahawks do put a lot of, they invest a lot in the agility testing at tight end. So all of their guys, Luke Wilson, Will Dissly, Nick Vinette, Anthony McCoy, Colby Parkinson, you know, all the players they've drafted, but then also the ones they've signed, Zach Miller, Greg Olsen, Gerald Everett, Jimmy Graham, who they traded for. They all have great short shuttle and three cones. And it's like when you have 10 years of data and there's the trend like that, you can't ignore it. You have to say that is a thing, and it is a thing. You know, and basically what it is if they run 7.10 seconds in a three cone or faster, there's a decent chance that that person will be on the Seahawks radar. And if they couple that with a great short shuttle, then there's a good chance that they will be on the Seahawks radar. And there are a few guys in this class who tick that box. And there are a couple of guys in particular who are inline blockers as well, who have got those testing numbers. And that's kind of what the Seahawks want, isn't it? So the two names really, I think, to focus on are John Bates at Boise State. I've been thinking he's going to be a late round pick. There's been a bit of a boost, shall we say, to his start. The draft boards, like myself, have been sort of, you know, we'll say that he's maybe moving up the boards, so to speak, and could be like a round five pick now. He ran a 6.85 three cone at 250 pounds, which is exceptional. Which, you know, to put that in context, none of the players the Seahawks have drafted or signed have ever run a three cone like that. I mean, Gerald Everett's was a 6.99, Jimmy Graham 6.90. You know, Will Disley 7.07. So we're talking about breaking new ground here with a 6.85.
Don't gloss over Anthony McCoy, who, you know, broke the seven barrier.
He did a 6.99, and that's probably why they drafted him.
Wasn't he a USC guy too?
He was a USC guy. Yeah. But, you know, so was Taylor Mays. I mean, this is the reason why they target these guys is because of the agility testing. They put a lot in this.
Anthony McCoy, I will continue to say Anthony McCoy was more interesting going in motion than any other tight end that I've seen. He had like a little prance that he'd do behind the line as he went in motion. I'll always remember Anthony McCoy for that.
I'll always remember Anthony McCoy because he scored a touchdown in that fantastic 2012 hammering of the San Francisco 49ers. He was amongst the... And whenever anybody mentions Anthony McCoy, the image in my mind immediately flashes of him scoring and then dunking the ball over the goalpost in the rain. And I just love that game. Brief sort of, sorry to go off on a tangent.
No, it's fine.
So going into that game.
You spent 10 minutes talking about Nick Chubb, so we can talk about Anthony McCoy's 2012 touchdown.
Well, going into that game against the Niners, I know a couple of Niners fans, and they were giving it biggin. As we say over in Yorkshire, they were giving it the biggin. Because they just won in New England, if you remember, the week before.
Mm.
And they fancied their chances. They thought they were going to come to Seattle. And of course, we knew better because we knew that the Seahawks in 2012 at that point were just a tsunami of brilliance. And it had been building and building and building. And I can remember just people sending me messages for that game. And I remember I stayed up because it was already a 1 o'clock in the morning start over here. And just as it was all unfolding and as Richard Sherman... Like that was probably the first real time that I really annoyed my wife because she was in bed and I was going absolutely nuts when Sherman ran back that blocked kick. Go on, Richard! Like shouting. Yes! Because I just knew at that point, there was like, what was that, 21-0 at the time? It was like, whoa! And you've got, that was the game with the Cam Chancellor hit.
You know, yeah.
I got a cheer. You know, it's like you've got Richard Sherman going like, hold this, to Jim Harbaugh. And, you know, you've got the Pete Carroll meme of him walking, which they did the Robber Baron thing.
Oh, that was that game too. Now I have to go back and watch that game.
You've got in Rain City Redemption, you've got the clip, I think, or at least on the Game Pass thing they have, if you watch the full game, when Red Bryant blocked the kick, didn't he? And then afterwards, Marshawn is on the sideline. Red Bryant sat down, probably having a rest because, you know, it's Red Bryant. Big guy, and he sat down there, and Marshawn's right in his face, just like getting in, going. And I just love everything about that game. That was watching that game was the first time I thought this team is going to win a Super Bowl. And whenever that game gets brought, and we absolutely hammered the Niners,
yeah.
And ever since from that, and that was the turning point because if you remember, that was the first time Carroll had beaten Harbaugh. I think Harbaugh was 3-0 against the Seahawks until that game. That game. We took San Francisco, so, and even though they got to the Super Bowl and lost, it was never the same. That 2012, the second game, it was just perfection. It was just, I think if you had to give me a choice of what is one game you'd like to go back and watch from complete, you know, commercial breaks and everything, it wouldn't be the Super Bowl and it wouldn't be the NFC Championship game against Green Bay or San Francisco, it would be that. I just, there's just so much, so many legendary moments in that game. So I'm very sorry that I had to go off on a tangent, but anytime anybody brings up that game, and I went into work the next day, it was Christmas Eve, I think, the next day. I was on the breakfast show and the radio for the BBC, so I'd not slept. I just went straight into work, no sleep, proud as anything, huge smile on my face. It was like a, it was a drug, that game. That just, it was like caffeine. It just kept me awake for the whole day.
So who has the chance to be the next Anthony McCoy? John Bates, Noah Gray, or Zach Davidson?
Back to John Bates. Yeah, so he's a great short shuttle inline blocker.
Don't laugh at my brilliant transition, Rob.
Yeah, it's been a weird podcast for that, hasn't it? These weird sort of tangents we keep going off, or I keep going off on.
Now, so we haven't talked in a long time, so this is bound to happen.
John Bates is an option. If they want to go for a tight end, you know, on day three, he's an option. Luke Farrell at Ohio State, another inline blocker, good short shuttle, 7.143 cone. Both these guys are explosive. So yeah, they're definite options. I think that, you know, a couple of later, Noah Gray was a guy at Duke. A lot of people were thinking was going to, could potentially go quite early in the draft before the season, for the 2020 season, and what happened with that. His stock has fallen somewhat, but a 6.903 cone, good short shuttle, good testing numbers, ran a 4.62. He's a bit smaller, 240, 31.5-inch arms. But I just wonder, actually, the Noah Gray, somebody that could run across the formation, working in the Shane Waldron system, could be somebody that they kind of look for there. And I think an undrafted guy, seventh-round flyer-type guy, Zach Davidson from Central Missouri. Again, great testing, 6.953 cone, 4.26 short shuttle, ran a 4.64. Somebody that they could look at. So there are some guys, but at the top, if you need a tight end, you're screwed.
Well, I think they have enough positions that they look that they can look for toward the top. And that brings up one of the positions on offense that we haven't yet talked about, and that's wide receiver, which is actually, gosh, when I look at your board, is incredibly deep.
Very, very deep. I found it harder this year to find somebody that definitively I want to go, that's an option. And it has been easier in the past. Do you remember Gary Jennings at West Virginia?
Right.
You only had to watch him and you could go, the Silk's going to draft him.
Mm.
You know, the way that he played, the downfield shots, the 4.440, everything about him, his size, he was a Silk. And they drafted him. And DK Metcalf, you could have said, well, you know, Pete's been banging on about getting this big receiver for 10 years and he's never got him. And here's the guy. You know, it's only a surprise they waited to the end of round two to take him instead of earlier. It's a bit harder to sort of say, oh, that's their guy. I mean, look, if Elijah Moore was a second or third round pick, he would be their guy. I think De'Ami Brown at North Carolina could be their guy, but I think he's going to go a lot earlier than a lot of people are projecting. I think he'll go in the top 45.
I'm really curious about Rondale Moore, though, and I know he's so small, but gosh, his athletic testing, in terms of a guy that... And I guess the wild card, too, in this is Shane Waldron and, you know, what might he be looking for in terms of the piece at receiver that could make his offense work to exactly how he wants it to. And clearly, Tyler Lockett, I was wondering if Tyler Lockett would be that guy. And clearly, with the extension, they see him as that guy. DK Metcalf, he can fit into any offense, although I think he fits into the Seahawks offense incredibly well. Who might be the guy on this list that would unlock the offense for Waldron?
You see, that's a great point. That's one of the things. What does Waldron want? That's a question that I would ask. Another question I would ask is, the Seahawks were really bad on third down last year. Who's the receiver that helps them get over that hump?
Yeah.
Is it someone internal? Are they just going to sort of say Freddie Swain and Metcalf and Lockett can do this and Gerald Everett and Waldron? Are they going to put it on them? Or is there somebody in this draft who they think that's a chain mover? That's a third down converter. He can run a slant. He can settle down. He can play in the slot and help us extend some drives. That's the other thing that I'm thinking of here. On top of, who do the Seahawks usually go for? I mean, like you mentioned Rondale Moore. And I, for ages, I had Rondale Moore as a first round guy because I knew the testing and I knew what the tape was two seasons ago. And then I sort of watched a lot of his stuff this year, and 2020 rather, and he just I struggle a bit with him because he doesn't, he's not a downfield threat. Like you can be his height, but you need to get downfield and you need to be an X factor. And he isn't. I don't know, his ball tracking, his contested catches, he doesn't do any of that. He's always around the formation. He's always kind of sweep. It's trick play. It's misdirection. It's settled down on a shorter. It's that kind of stuff. And is to me, the concern is he just too much of a gadget player? Is he almost exclusively a gadget player?
I would almost argue that they need that, though, because they have the guys that can go downfield. You know, a guy who fits that Golden Tate type role, right?
But that's the thing, is that when you watch Tate play for Notre Dame, the one thing Tate did superbly well was get downfield. He was always downfield, 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 contested catches. He made Jimmy Clausen. I mean, it was incredible. I mean, like, I studied Clausen so much in that draft because the Seahawks needed a quarterback. It was Carroll's first draft. They had two first-round picks. Clausen was said to be like a potential first-round pick. But you just kept getting drawn to Tate because of the downfield shots all of the time, winning and winning and winning against USC, against the, you know, whoever. And
well, maybe Percy Harvin would be a better example of that in the Seahawks system then.
Potentially so. I struggle with Rondale Moore to project where he's going to go, because he could go higher. I could see him lasting to round 3 or 4 because he's had injuries as well, and he's not played that much. I find it. And the other thing is the height is the. So I was like, look, I have wrapped my brain. I spent so much time this week trying to work out who are the receivers that they're going to go for, and then I was sort of thinking, well, is height an issue? Like, people have been talking about Jalen Darden and De Eskridge, people like that, as well as Rondale Moore. And I thought, well, what kind of height have they gone for? And I went down the list, and like Tyler Lockett is 5'10", and that's kind of as short as they've gone.
Right.
You know, even Golden Tate was pushing 5'11", 6 foot, believe it or not. So they don't really draft the really short players. And that doesn't mean they all have to be 6'4", but it's kind of like, you know, that 6 foot. Part of me wonders whether or not they'll target someone who's a bit like David Moore in terms of physical appearance, because they've lost David Moore, and they often try and do that kind of thing. And, you know, someone like Rashad Bateman is practically the same. He's 20 pounds lighter, but every testing number and arm length and hand size and everything is the same as David Moore. But I think Bateman might be too high. But see, he's a great chain mover as well, and he ran a 4.4, so he ticks a lot of boxes. And I could see him working in Waldron's system. But again, I don't know if he's going to be there at 56, let alone if they trade down. So it is actually quite the challenge, Brandon, to work out who are they going to take. And, like, you know, it's I could make an eye. I found it really hard.
Well, last year was a deep receiver class too, and they waited till round 6 to draft a receiver. So, I mean, they could do that again, I suppose.
I mean, I'll very quickly. So Tylan Wallace is an option because he's probably going to be in round 3. Okay, gets downfield very well. Could convert third downs easy. Could run across the formation. Could work in the Waldron system. But you don't really know. Like, he ran like a 4.45 or something like that. It could easily be a 4.55 at the combine. And they don't draft players who run that slow. And the speed with him has always been a bit of an issue. He's so competitive. He is a good downfield receiver. He makes those big plays downfield. It could be Tylan Wallace, but then he might not even be considered because of his speed. I don't know, because we don't have a combine to definitively say, yes, he's a 4.4 runner. So that sort of throws a question there. Bateman, how early is he going to go? De Eskridge. My God, De Eskridge could be perfect for them because he's so fast, explosive. He's a kick returner. He can be big time on special teams straight away, if nothing else. He does move the chains. He does do what Rondale Moore doesn't do, which is get downfield and make this huge chunk plays. He can settle down. He can make the contested catches. He's so exciting. He's so explosive. He's played cornerback, so he kind of knows a little bit about the defensive side of things as well. He's 24, which is a downside. But, you know, there's a lot of things to like about De Eskridge. Could he be? But he's 5'8". And it's like, well, again, they've not drafted anybody like that before. Right. Do they do this year? Maybe, but I can't. I almost don't. I want to find someone who can go, that's the guy. And I can't find the person that I can definitely do that with. Nico Collins, people like Nico Collins, ran a 4.4 at the Michigan Pro Day. I don't think he's anywhere near a 4.4 runner. Watch his Senior Bowl 1v1s. He's like a sloth. You know, he doesn't get into his breaks. He's so slow. He's good in the red zone, but he's not good at creating separation. Kay Johnson was fantastic at creating separation at the Senior Bowl. But how fast he ran a 4.49 at his Pro Day? Is he a 4.5 runner? Is he just a bit too similar to Tyler Lockett? Shai Smith? Do you draft a guy like that early? I mean, I don't know. Amon-Ra St. Brown's too slow. Anthony Schwartz is 4.2 runner. He's an amazing athlete. But for me, he's the kind of player that just signs for somebody else in 4 years' time. He's kind of like a bit of a role player for a bit. And then he joins like the Vikings in 4 years or somebody like that. And you want to draft somebody you believe can be like a Metcalf or a Lockett for you if you're going to go reasonably early.
The thing, and part of the reason why I brought up Shane Waldron too, is that, and I know we don't know this, so it is good to look historically and say that, okay, they've never really drafted guys who didn't have that 4.4 speed, except in the seventh round, right, where they're drafting guys who run a 4.5. But if you look at the Rams and the offense that Shane Waldron's coming from, Robert Woods ran a 4.5 at the combine. Cooper Kupp ran a 4.6 at the combine. And you're telling me that my message to John Schneider then would be that you're telling me you wouldn't take guys like Robert Woods or Cooper Kupp for this team just because they didn't run a 4.4 and these guys have the ability to get open extremely well. And so why not look at other aspects of it and not just toss guys out because of their speed?
I don't know who's making that call. I mean, it may be John, it may be Pete, it may be both.
It may be, yeah.
I don't know, but they've always placed a real value on suddenness and quickness and burst. That's just what they've done. And
it makes sense at the NFL level that you want guys who can separate, especially at receiver, and speed as it, you know, equates to separation.
I think they use that. They plan the draft. They want to give themselves the best chance to have success.
Right.
And I think that Carroll is a development coach, and he thinks, if I get a guy in with the tools, that I can turn those tools into an effective player. And I think that's really what it is. And they say, okay, we could draft a 4.65 runner, and we could develop them. But if I get a 4.4 runner, I believe I can develop him. And he's therefore, if he's got the skills and we've got the development, it's just an easier, more it's a higher probability of success. I think that's how they view it. Maybe they will change it for this year. I just get a feeling that, like, it's what, how much do you put on the Waldron thing? It may be, I always feel like they might go to Waldron and go, here's six guys to watch, please, Shell, maybe 10 or 20, I don't know. Who do you like? These are the 20 guys on our board. Who do you like? Mm-hmm. And then they'll take his input and they'll use that as part of the whole process of deciding who they want. But they'll go to him with a list as opposed to, you go and watch who you like. And if they run a 4.7, then we might take them anyway. I just think that's the way it will be. And there are other guys. I think because of this, and this is, I've kind of come to this thought as we've just been talking about it, Brandon. If I'm sat here, I'm not for a second saying the Seahawks are thinking what I'm saying here, but I'm saying I can't find the definitive Seahawks receiver. Maybe that it means they do what they did with Freddie Swain. They just go, look, we can't find somebody. We want to take him with the first pick. We're that sold on him. So what we'll do is we'll see who's there in round 5 or 6 or 7 or whenever they're picking, and we'll take a guy with the traits that we like. And like I did a simulation on Friday, is Tamorian Terry somebody like that on day 3 who has got 4.4 speed and is got a size similar to Moore, you know, to David Moore? Do they just take him and say, we'll see if he can make it work?
Yeah.
Erase him at math. You know, somebody like that who can also contribute on special teams very, very well. Do they just go with somebody like that in round 6 and say, well, that's what we're going to do? Because as good as this receiver class is, there isn't anybody who just says, you must take me.
Well, and special teams might be the thing that draws you to a particular player then, because when you're talking about, even when you're talking about wide receiver 3, you're talking about receiving option number 5 or 6 in terms of how it plays out with the Seahawks offense. So at that point, there's probably more value in terms of special teams, whether it's at gunner or, you know, however they decide to use that. That could be the thing that tips them, especially when you're getting outside of round 2 and 3.
Yeah, I think it's going to be interesting.
Or a returner. I don't even know if we've really landed on a guy who can be the return guy after Tyler Lockett.
And there are some guys who can do that in this class. You know, Eskridge is definitely one of them. Rondale Moore could potentially be a good guy for that. Kay Johnson has done some returning. You know, Anthony Schwartz has certainly got the speed for it. Darden's done it. I'm trying to think who else has done it. Tutu Atwell's done it, I think. I think I've seen Trey Nixon return kicks. De'Ami Brown's done it. You know, you'd have no issue with some of the guys at the top of the draft doing it. So there's some there. I mean, like, you've got DJ Reed, haven't they, who looked really good as a kick returner in the back end of last year. But they may, if he's starting cornerback, they might want to risk him on kick return. Exactly. So if you can get... I've mocked D.S. Eskridge to Seattle for those kind of reasons. It's like you get a kick returner, you get a wide receiver three, and he fits Waldron, he fits Cowell a little bit. It's just the age and the height, really, that puts me off. He could be an option for them, but I just get a feeling that O-line will probably be their first pick.
Offensive line definitely seems like a place to watch. It would make a lot of sense on a few levels. He's Rob Staton of Seahawks Draft Blog. Rob, what do you got coming up on the blog ahead of the draft?
Hopefully some nice live streams and some stuff like that. I'm going to sort of have a lot of different sort of angles and predictions and hopefully some Q&As. I'm trying to set up a couple of interesting interviews before the draft. On draft day, I'll probably do usual live blog and then jump on a stream immediately afterwards and give some thoughts on the first round. And then on each of the Seahawks picks, I'm incredibly looking forward to the draft, even though there's only three picks. And I hope that people will join us on Seahawks Draft Blog and will be engaging in the debate and having a lot of fun with it.
A big thanks once again to Rob for coming on the show. We actually spent a bit more time talking defense as well, but I'm going to save that for the next show before the draft. And hopefully Adam will be in a spot to record one show ahead of the draft. But if not, then it'll just be a little bit shorter show with Rob coming up next week. And closing out the show here, Jason Turner emails in and says, Alden Catfish Smith. I think that says it all. News came out on Monday that Alden Smith is wanted for second-degree battery for an incident on April 17th at French Press Coffee House in Louisiana. So we will see what comes of that. The Seahawks, they did release an official statement saying that they're aware of the situation, but probably still a lot to wait for in terms of details. Something we will be watching in the next few weeks. A big thanks to our executive producers, Dustin Mock, Brian Shaw, and Young Choi. We did have some new members of the flock coming in at getintheflock.com. I will wait for Adam to be back and we can thank all of you there. Why don't we close this show out with a Better at Life nomination? Because Alex Smith announced his retirement on Monday. And man, just for that guy to come back from what he did, I think he's probably a Better at Life nominee previous, just for making the comeback, being able to make the start within the season. I'm sure we talked about it plenty, but he officially announces his retirement following the season. And it makes a ton of sense considering what he's dealt with over this past year. Just, I know a lot of us worried about his health and wellness after coming back from such a gruesome injury. He wins the Comeback Player of the Year award for being able to make it back and being able to be productive in the quarterback spot. So he goes out with a winning record in his 16-year career, and actually pretty heavily on the winning side. I think he was at least 20, 30 games over 500. So an excellent career for Alex Smith, better at life than Skip Bayless. And yes, closing it out with a player who is not a member of the Seahawks. But I think with that, there's only one thing left to say. Go Hawks!
Philip has just lost the respect of the youth league football team he coaches. He was asked what New England should do in the draft, and his answer was objectively terrible. The Athletic just wrote a great article about this, but Philip doesn't have the Athletic or the respect of a boisterous group of 11-year-olds who once looked up to him. Learn from Philip's error, get the Athletic, and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.